afternoon, and welcome to week 40. That's why I put the numbers at the top at this point, on the top of the sheet. Just it feels good, you know, like week 40. That's great. Yeah. A couple of practical notes before we jump in here. One particular practical note is that the break will be the last two Tuesdays in December. So that's December 22nd and 29th. Hopefully people will remember where we were when we resume in January.
If not, you'll send us an email and
yeah.
Listen to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yes, the recordings should be available. We will not pull them down. So that would... Yeah. Okay, that was one. And then the other, I felt bad at the end of last session about one point, and especially because it sort of replayed itself in a separate program. I mentioned when I introduced a comment by Professor Torsini, so I gave you a sense of who he is and his sort of approach and why I'm not necessarily a fan of that approach in general. And the example that I gave sort of, yielded some laughter, and with reason. The approach that he takes is interestingly glib and doesn't really support itself with a whole lot of evidence for the change that he's making to a foundational text. Nonetheless, I want to be very clear here that to my mind, the people who are engaged in this study believe that they're engaged in something very serious, and more to the point, the techniques they use are often very useful, having nothing to do with amending a text. The techniques themselves, the issue of looking at what's going on in the cultures around the Jews, and seeing the history of it, looking at literary elements, I think those are very useful and powerful, having nothing to do with dealing with authorship and having nothing to do with amending a text, but just in terms of understanding what's in front of us. We've used techniques, and I don't only mean Carol Newsom, in the course of studying Eov, in the course of studying Job. So, even though the particular example that I gave, I understand laughing at it, and it is funny. Nonetheless, I think it's important to recognize the serious elements of that field of study. Okay, which brings us to, the section before, the really difficult section, but we're in chapters 23 and 24. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want page 1650-1651. This is Job's last response to Eliphaz's last speech. And again, remember, Eliphaz had accused Job of terrible wrongdoing in response to Job saying there's no order in the world. So Eliphaz had said, you bet there is, and you, Job, you are wicked. We ask the question of how serious Eliphaz is. Is he really serious in this allegation? Probably not, given that the fact that he waits till chapter 22. To say it, and his third speech, and also given the fact that it doesn't fit the book's description of Job as somebody who is very righteous, it just doesn't square with what Eliphaz is saying. So we offered various explanations for why Eliphaz could have been driven to say this, and that brought us to Job's response, and he began by saying, you should know, in case you were wondering, I'm still miserable, despite what you're telling me. I want to summon God to a trial, and God would aid me in my trial because he knows that I am righteous. He knows that I am a good guy. Even watching from afar, God knows that I am just. He has tested me, and I have emerged like pure gold. Possible hint at what, in fact, is going on in the book, that he is, in fact, being tested. But there's no arguing with God, and that is why I fear him. And that led to that was all chapter 23. Chapter 24, he began with a long section. Well, not he began with, the whole thing is a long section, saying, where is God's justice? Wicked people are thriving. And he describes the wicked as, in particular, thieves. They steal land, they steal flocks, they take the donkey and the ox from the orphan and the widow. And then, he said, they also enslave the needy. They use them for their own purposes. And that brought us to chapter 24, sentence 7, in which he describes the suffering of those needy people who are being enslaved. Okay, chapter 24, sentence 7, page 1650, 1651. Everyone has it? Okay. This is in the middle of his discussion about how they enslave the needy. So we're sort of picking up in the middle of it. He says, Arom yalinu mibli levush ve'en ksus bakara. They lie down unclothed. They have no clothing. Ve'en ksus, there is no clothing, bakara, in the core, in the cold. And you see the poetry of what he's doing, even as this is, you know, sort of an expression of misery, and boy, are those people terrible. He has the presence of mind to include arom, right, unclothed, beli levush, levush being one term for clothing, and ein ksut, ksut being another term for clothing. You know, it only testifies to what we suggested in the beginning of our study, which is that this is not a spur-of-the-moment speech, but rather this is something stylized, and even if there was some kind of a dialogue that went on between Job and friends, at some point this has to be redacted. People just don't speak this way. You don't, you know, a person who is suffering and miserable with boils, and he lost his family, and he lost everything, you know, complaining about what the wicked do to harm the needy, doesn't express himself, you know, with a sentence like this. Mizerem harim yirtavu, umibali machseh chibku tsur. Mizerem harim, from the flow of mountains, meaning the rain flowing down or the melted snow perhaps, yirtavu, they will become wet, these vulnerable people who have been enslaved by the wicked. Umibali machseh, and without shelter, chibku tsur. They hug, they embrace a boulder for protection. I don't think that he's using Tsur here for God. Yeah, I wondered about it also. Tsur, capital Tzadi, you know, God. So they turn to God, they embrace God. I don't think that's what he's saying here, but it's an interesting layer. Yes, Carla?
Although, that's here in another commentary, too, there is a reference to Yeshayahu 25:4, which has very similar language.
Right. But but is Yeshayahu using it in the sense of God, or is he also using it? Oh, he is.
I think so, yeah.
Let's take a look. Let's take a look. Page 994.
Or at least a protecting rock.
Right, well, that's what it would be here, too. Yeah, Isaiah 25:4. You want page 994, 995. He is praising God here for helping out those who were needy. And he says of God, Ki ayisa ma'oz ladal, you were a source of strength for the poor. Ma'oz lahevyon batzar lo, a source of strength, or a source of strength for the indigent when he was in trouble. Machseh mizerem, right, which is like the term zerem that's used here, right, a shelter from the flow of water. Tzel mechorev, shade from the heat. Ki ruach aritzim kizerem kir. Because the wind of the aritzim, of the tyrants, the kizerem kir, sorry, the what's that? Kiruach aritzim kizerem kir, like the damp, oh, against the wall. I see, but he doesn't talk about chibku tsur. He's not. Where do you see tsur? Or are they just they're just talking about the zerem and the
and the stronghold. I'm merely quoting the commentator.
I see. Okay, so yeah, the commentator. It's a nice. Certainly, there are analogies in the description of God as a protector, but the chibku tsur is not something that emerges there. Susan.
Can I go back over?
Yeah.
Also, it says that they steal clothes. Where I'm looking at the Hebrew over and over, and I don't know what word he would have used for steal.
Right, and the answer isn't so much that it's that the verse doesn't say they steal the clothing, it's how did these people end up without clothing?
Oh.
In other words, when Job is giving this description, he's trying to show the way that these horrible people have abused the vulnerable. So if he says they don't have clothing, it isn't only to say they didn't give them clothing, it's to say they took the clothing that those people had. Yeah. Pasuk Tet, sentence 9, admits of a couple of different interpretations depending on how you translate the word shod. Yigzalu mishod yasom, ve'al oni yachbolu. So the word shod can refer to nursing, or the word shod can refer to theft. And either one can be a legitimate translation. Either Ralbag Mitzudat David say, they steal so much, showed as in theft, they steal so much that even the atom, even the orphan, they will steal from. Mi showed, meaning as a result of showed, because they are so immersed in showed, in theft, they will even steal from the atom, from the orphan, val oni yachabolu, and they will take the property of the pauper as security. And that's one way to read it. The other way to read it is, yigzalu mi showed yasom, they will steal away the orphan who is nursing, while he is nursing, which suggests either orphan from his father and not from his mother, because otherwise how is he nursing, or alternatively that there's some third party who is nursing him. But they will take away the yasom who is still a nursling, and then the rest of the sentence is still the same, val ani yachabolu, and they will take the pauper's clothing as security. And there, I assume it's the clothing as security, but it could be they take the pauper himself as security, either way. But the image here, and what you want to emerge from here, if you don't want to get bogged down in textual specifics, is this image of merciless people. The people who Eliphaz said, that's you, Job, right? He says, no, I'm not like them. This is what they do, and it's horrible, and you know, don't lay this on me. I would never do such a thing. You know what those people do? They do that, that, that. And this is the corruption that God allows to go on in this world, and he doesn't punish. Yeah?
Could this be some kind of a catharsis for Eof? Because this whole speech about him, it doesn't have anything to do with him.
It has nothing to do with him, correct, except as a response to Eliphaz. In other words, Eliphaz says there is order, and if you are suffering, then it must be because you did terrible things, and that's why God is punishing you. He says, you know, there are a whole bunch of people out there who do these terrible things, and they're not being punished. It's not so much about about his state as a response to Eliphaz.
That's why he's overdrive.
Well, he's been in overdrive since approximately chapter 4. Yeah, that's the outrage of Job. I don't know that I would chapter 3 really. Chapter 4 was already Eliphaz's start. But I think if he was going to get catharsis through speech, that should have happened already. Don't know. Pasukud, sentence 10. Arom hilchu b'li levush. Once again, he reiterates. They walk unclothed without clothing. Ure'evim nas'u omer. And the hungry carry the sheaf. Meaning either they are forced to carry the sheaves even as they are hungry. That's one way to take a look at it. Or alternatively, that the wicked people are taking the sheaf away from the hungry person. You could read it either way. What is this adding to what we said before? Dat Mikra suggests that before they were unclothed in the nighttime. It was talking about how they lie down and they have no shelter and so on. This is talking about by day while they're working in the fields. That they're not given anything, they have no shelter. Sentence 11, chapter 24, sentence 11. Bein shuro sam yatz hiru, yikavim darchu vayitzma'u. Which, again, multiple possible interpretations. Either it's talking about the workers they have forced to work. And it says, Bein shuro sam yatz hiru, between the rows of the olive trees, they make oil. Yikavim darchu, they trample in the wine press. Vayitzma'u, and they are thirsty all along. They're making oil and they're making wine, but they have nothing for themselves. That's one way to take it. However, if you catch the language in the Hebrew, bein shuro sam. What does shuro sam, shuro tam mean?
Their rows.
If it's the worker, the worker doesn't own the row. So Rashi gives a different explanation. He says this is the proprietor. The people who own the orchards, the people who own the vineyards, are the ones who are making the oil and then making the wine, and then it is stolen from them. And that's why they thirst. Shana.
This reminds me about when God said, you can't muzzle the ox from threshing the grain.
Right.
Because it's cruel to him.
Right. So, and the ox isn't even the owner.
Right.
like
right.
us as being human.
Right. Right. And as a matter of fact, we have a normal, we have a rule, the other rule that, that you might think of along with that, that says that when a worker is harvesting in the field, he has to be allowed to eat. Right? The worker who is harvesting your field is supposed to be allowed to eat from the produce as long as he doesn't put it into his pail to bring home. That's a no-no. But eating on the job is allowed. And here, this is the proprietor, as Rashi explains it. This is the proprietor owning the orchard, owning the vineyard, and yet going thirsty. I should also note, for those who were with us a couple of years ago when we did Bereishis Rabbah, the ones who it's their fault we're doing Job now. So we saw many midrashim there that drew verses from Job. This section in particular, we saw there was a lot of discussion about the generation of the flood and their abuse of others that is brought as parallel to what's going on here. The Hamas that they engage in is what's described here, and that's going to come up on several verses in this chapter. Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12. Meir Misim Yinaku, from the city they cry out, and Yinaku is a funny word. It means to cry out, but it's often used as a term for like a donkey crying. It's an animal type of right naka. It's not only there. I think in Sodom, naka tam, right. You find that as well. But it's an expression like an animal type of a sobbing is what we're talking about. V'nefesh chalalim tishaveya, and the soul of chalalim literally means corpses. They're not actually dead, but that's the idea, is that they're near death. The nefesh chalalim tishaveya cries out. The eloka, and here is where he turns and he points the finger to Eliphaz. The eloka lo yasim tifla, and God does nothing about it. God does nothing about it. Now the word tifla is a funny word. If you take a look at the art school, let's see what they do as a translation for tifla. God does not lay guilt. So they're taking the view that Rashi takes. Rashi says that it's a statement of guilt, blame. Ibn Ezra says tifla means something empty and worthless. Right. Well, not tafel with a tet, though. Tafel with a taf. More like tafel. We use tafel to mean bland. So that would be an explanation. And then there's Mitzudat David, who actually takes it in another way altogether. He says he's actually accusing God of corruption, which may fit with what's coming next in the chapter. He says, Velokala Yasim Tifla is a question. How can you tell me that God is not involved in Tifla? God, how can you say that God is not involved in something inappropriate, in something corrupt? You follow? So either he's simply saying God doesn't do anything about it, and that's sort of the standard approach among the commentators, and that's his response to Eliphaz. You say if God is hurting me, it must be because I did stuff that was wrong. Look at all those things that are happening. God's not doing anything for them. Or, stronger, Mitzudat David is saying that you say God is punishing me because I've done things that are wrong. God is complicit in what everybody else is doing. God is enabling them. He's making them successful. How can you say that God isn't helping them?
So what does Tifa mean if you take Mitzudat David?
I think he will go with the guilt, blame type of an approach that Rashi uses, that Mikra uses. That it's actually a negative, not only bland, but that it's actually negative. Right. If you're familiar with the word tiflut, as it's used in the Gemara, without going into a whole discussion about that, it's the same word. And the different translations there will be the different translations here. Okay. So he has said that the wicked people are stealing, that the wicked people are harming the vulnerable. And then in the last part of this section, he talks about the wicked operating at night. And there's a really interesting interplay. Yeah?
Just a quick question before. By him saying that God is ignoring sinners who are not getting involved. Is, okay, are we saying that that is, like, is he, what's the word for coherent English? Is he sort of denying? Or is he just understanding that there is this understanding that there is left evil in the world?
Well, I think he's saying this bolsters my point, that God is not... If I take the first approach, if I don't take Mitzvot David, then he's saying what he has said all along, which is, God just lets it go. He's not denying God's existence. He's been very clear that he believes in a God, even if his version of God is not what we think of as, you know, like a Jewish version of things. That's, you know, that doesn't bind him.
But isn't a little bit that the Jewish version of the understand that there is evil in this world and that Hashem created evil and good? That's a Jewish understanding. It's still, you know, in line that we understand. I mean, it still comes from.
Right. No, that's true. But within sort of the standard traditional take, it's God lets it go temporarily for whatever plan and whatever reason he has, and somehow he's going to make it work out. Job is it stopped before that sentence ended. Job says, no, God lets it go. That's it. No justice, no nothing, and things just happen. The last section here, you're going to get this play of day versus night, and the wicked thriving at night in particular. Stephen?
It's our concept of evil is that evil is under God's realm, Hashem's realm. Others believe that evil is a separate realm from that. Maybe that's what.
I mean, he's not going.
It's evil and good, and God is good.
He's not going Zoroastrian. In other words, he's not proposing that there are demonic forces working against God, and God is just powerless to stop them in some kind of battle. He's saying God doesn't care. Or, worse, God is aiding and abetting, which is actually one of the views that we're going to see before this chapter is done. But let's take a look at this section here, because it's in our way. This Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13, he speaks of a group called Mordei Or. Mordei Or, literally, is those who rebel against the light. That's the those who rebel against the light. And he says, Hey Mahayu b'mordei or. Those wicked people are among those who rebel against the light. Lo ikiru derachav. They don't know its ways. Velo yashvu b'nesivosav. And they do not sit in its paths. They don't go where the light is. What does that mean? Who are the people who rebel against the light? So, if you take a look at source number one on your sheet, I brought you Rashi. Rashi and Ibn Ezra, it's an interesting tandem there, say that or, light, doesn't mean light. It means capital L, light. As in?
Cosmic light.
God. Well, divine light. Right, God, in other words. And so you see Rashi here, do as I said before, associating this chapter with the generation of the flood. These wicked people are the generation of the flood who rebelled against the light. Because they had the rain which ascended from the ground. And what he's talking about there is in the very beginning of the Chumash, you get a mist rises from the ground. And the idea that there's a natural water cycle, and and that's what provides rain, and there's no need for divine intervention, evaporation, precipitation, and it just works on its own, and we don't need God. Yeah.
It reminds me also a little bit of the organ of Nehoshet from the war school from Kivan.
Good. So actually, there's a whole school of thought in among the critics on this, who say Mordei Or is a reference to sort of a legendary battle that had gone on in history. The forces who rebel against the light are those who battle against God. And they say what he's doing here is he's saying these wicked people who you talk about, they're like those legendary figures. The problem is we don't have the story that he's referring to, so it's hard to match anything up. But they'll actually read the whole rest of the chapter along those lines. So they recognize they are bimordei or. Among those wicked people who rejected God is Rashi's take, that's Ibn Ezra's take as well. Mitsudat David has a very interesting alternative approach. If you take a look at source number 2, I brought this just because it was interesting, although I don't quite see it fitting everything in the chapter. But he says that Job is referring to people who are depressed, and therefore they avoid the light. He says, "V'heim ha'anashim asher yisgaber bam choli ha'shechora." These are the people whose black illness grows in them. Asher yimasu l'sheves b'makom ha'or. They hate to sit in illuminated places. Kim b'choshach yishevu. They'll only sit in the dark. And this is an old idea. There's a Mishnah in Shabbos that talks about, it's part of the chapter of Bamei Malkin, which is traditionally set Friday night. It talks about what would justify extinguishing a flame on Shabbos. And one of them is b'pnei ruach ra'ah, which literally translates to because of an evil spirit, because of a bad spirit. And the Rambam, in his commentary on the Mishnah, says what they're talking about is somebody who is depressed, his word for it is melancholy, and who doesn't want to be around people and doesn't want to be in the light, and you'd be allowed to extinguish the flame under certain circumstances for this person. You wouldn't be biblically liable for doing so. So,
was this not used against the Karaites 1,000 years ago?
How would it be used against the Karaites?
Because they sit in the dark.
They do, but I think that's a happy coincidence. I don't think the yeah.
There are people who do that today.
But in terms of what's being said here, so Mitzudat David said the point is not to say they're like those who rebel against God. Mordei Or, in Mitzudat David's understanding, is not a pejorative. It's these terrible people sit in the dark like people who can't stand to be in the light. That's the way that he reads this. Either way, lo ikiru drachav, they don't know his ways, which are either the ways of God or the ways of light. The lo yashvu b'nisivosav, they do not sit in his paths. And then he says, pasuk yedalid, sentence 14. And here, you know, in general, in this section, there are a few ways you could translate things. I'm going to just follow one straight translation because we haven't hit the hard part yet. Laor yakum rotzeach yiktol ani ve'evyon uvalayla yehi chaganav. By or, the murderer will rise. In other words, they kill people by daylight. Yes, yiktol. I hope that's them. Yiktol ani ve'evyon. They kill the poor. They kill the indigent. Uvalayla yehi chaganav. And then at night, they go steal. Dat Mikra says, because no one's on the road at night. They don't have any victims out there to go kill. So therefore, they have to go into the houses and start stealing there. The problem with this translation is that we had assumed they were afraid of the light. Why are they then going out and murdering by day? So Mitzudat David suggests it means they rise early before the light. Laor, they rise early in the morning to do this, and then they're done for the day until the nighttime. Ve'ein no'eif shamra neshef lemor lo sishureini ayin. And the eye of the no'eif, a no'eif is an adulterer, the eye of the adulterer waits for neshef, waits for dusk and night, saying, lo sishureini ayin, no eye will see me, v'seiser panim yasim. And he will, v'seiser panim yasim, was that they? I wrote in my notes. They turn their face towards darkness. Is that how they render it here? Actually, hard to render that one. He applies himself to sin in concealment. So yeah, they turn their face to the to that which is hidden. The funny thing that he did here, which we have not seen before, is the reference to the no'eif. In other words, we've accused wicked people of all sorts of crimes, but that hasn't been on the list. You know, theft, murder, you know, those things, you bet. But that no'eif, adultery, has not really been on this list, so much so that some commentators suggest what he's saying is that they are like adulterers and that they wait for the night, but not that he's accusing them of that. That's not their particular crime. Yeah.
It's probably a detail, but the way he describes the murderer as almost compulsive obsessive control. I mean, if they see people, they have to kill them. And if they don't see people, they have to do something bad.
Yes.
They can't help them.
Exactly right.
They couldn't be able to help themselves.
To go back to the flood generation, kol hayom.
Yeah.
Only bad all day long. Whatever they're going to do is going to be negative. You will not catch these people dormant. They're not lazy people.
And they can't help themselves.
Right.
Let's talk. Can they help?
Well, can't help themselves, I wouldn't necessarily say. They're helping themselves just fine. Pasuk Tet Zayin, sentence 16. Chasar b'choshech batim. They tunnel into houses in the dark. Yomam chitmu lamo. By night, by day, chitmu lamo. They are sealed up. They're sealed up by day. Lo yaduor, they don't know the light. And again, that adds the difficulty of the phrase before, which sounded like they were acting by light. And then the last sentence in the section, ki yachdav boker lamo tzalmaves, ki yakir balhos tzalmaves. He says, these people, these murderers, thieves, adulterers, they shun the day like the shadow of death. They know the demons of night, balhot, which is a term we've seen a couple of times now in this book, the frightening creatures of the night, they know them very well. So what Job has done is to describe the wicked, to describe the terrible things they do to others, to describe how they hide from the light and commit their crimes in ways that people won't see them, and they escape punishment. Nothing is happening to them. Clear? Are we clear so far? Because if we're not, we need to know now, because we're about to fall off a cliff. What Job has been saying to Eliphaz is really a simple response to him. There's nothing terribly complicated about what he's doing. He's saying, you say, if I'm suffering, it must be because I did terrible things? No. People do terrible things all the time. God doesn't care. God may even be complicit with it, according to that one read that we saw. And now, in the next sentences, till the end of the chapter, sentences 18 to 25, what he says, if I were to read it as a straight text, sounds like he is saying that wicked people are going to suffer. You could read this straight and read it, if you look at the sheet, I gave you different approaches to reading this. But approach number three is, quite frankly, the simplest read of these difficult sentences. It says, the wicked are indeed going to suffer. If you take a look, let's read the sentences, go through it with the simple read, and you'll see what I mean. Sentence 18, which I'm reading here now with a combination of Ibn Ezra, Mitzudat David, and the JPS translation. Kal hu al pnei mayim, tikulal chalkasam ba'aretz, lo yifne derech keramim. This is another one we saw in the Medrash here. But kal hu al pnei mayim, they flee swiftly across the water. Tikulal chalkasam ba'aretz, their portion on land is accursed. Lo yifne derech keramim, he's not going to be able to flee into those vineyards. Pasuk Yutet, sentence 19. Tziya gam chom yigzalu meimei sheleg. Ruin, desert, heat will steal away the melted snow. Sheol chata'u, that's what Sheol, the grave, does to those who have sinned. Just like snow just melts away, that's what's going to happen to these horrible people. Yishkacheyu rechem misako rima. Od lo yizacher. The womb will forget him. Meaning the womb of his mother, is going to forget him. Decay will be sweet to him. Olo yizacher, he'll be forgotten. Vatishaver ka'etz avla, and corruption is broken like a stick. This is Job talking. This is Eov talking. He says, they're going to flee. They're not going to find a place to hide. They're going to melt away like the snow in the desert. They'll be forgotten by their own mother. No one will remember them. They'll be broken like a stick. This is his prediction of what's going to happen. Then he says they are brutal people. Pasuk Chaval, sentence 21. Ro'eh akara lo seled. They harm the childless person. who never gives birth. And the idea here is they have no protector. They don't produce a child who can grow up to avenge them. Ve'almana lo yeitiv. He will not help the widow. Umashach abirim bechocho. He drags along the mighty with his strength. Yakum v'lo ya'amin b'chayin. So much so that not so much so. He drags along the mighty, and yet he, the wicked person, will rise, and he will not trust in his own life. Despite his strength, he will live in fear. Yitain lo levetach v'yisha'ein. God gives him security, a little bit of security, and waits patiently. Ve'einehu al darcheihem. And God is watching their ways. Pasuk Chaf Dalet, sentence 24. Rumu me'at ve'einenu. They grow a little bit. They're elevated a bit. And then they are gone. V'humchu kakol yikafzun. They become low, like mach. They will become low. They will be snapped up like everybody else. Ukarosh shibolas yimalu. They will be crushed like the end of a stalk. V'imlo eifo miach siveni. And if I'm wrong, who is going to contradict me? Who will prove that what I'm saying is not true? V'yasein le'al milasi. Who can make my words not? Who can defeat what I am saying? Yes.
So he's talking about himself, essentially, because that's what happened to him. So is he including himself in the ranks of the wicked after everything that Eliphaz said?
Good question.
Does he deny Eliphaz for accusing him?
It's what it sounds like, no? Rebecca, and then... Yeah.
But it almost seems like, where did this come from? And it almost seems like it shouldn't be coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
This should come from one of his friends rather than from him. And you wonder what... We have no reason to see a change of heart. So it almost seems like there's...
This doesn't belong here.
It doesn't belong here.
Right.
Exactly.
Carla.
Or he is so super cynical and he's basically filling in what...
Let me take your part now. Now you're going to say...
But he doesn't say that.
He's giving the logical conclusion... Because this, if you follow Eliphaz's argument, which he's also already throwing back in his face, then this is what logically should happen to your wicked people.
But it's not happening. In his speech, that's what's missing there.
Because he's questioning. There are no more categories of bad people left.
Right. In fact, we did see in an earlier chapter that Eo turned to them and said, "Let me speak first, and then you'll make fun of me." Like, he has done this style of speech before, where he sort of speaks both sides, and he says, "I know what you're going to say, let me just say what I want to say." So that's true, but there's no prompt here. There's no. It doesn't sound like he's shifting gears. It sounds like it's just a flow. So this is why I had "ha" on the sheet for the last 2 weeks, because I was sitting there like, I don't know how to read this. And
so this is where Torsi and I would say we're missing a puzzle.
So actually, Torsi and I does not.
Oh, really? Interesting.
It's very interesting. We're going to see a lot of that school did it historically, but there's a shift as you get to more recent decades to say, no, this belongs here, you have to read it, you have to do something else with it. What Torah Sinai does is he actually reads it, part of it as a statement that their sin is forgotten in Sheol, then there's a citation of the visitors, and then he's challenging them, saying, how can you believe this? That's the way he reads it. I wasn't going to go into it here, but just because you asked, that's what he does.
Or it will be part of Bildad's speech, which comes the introductory...
Right. But that's one take. So... This is a very hard way to read this. I want to show you two other ways to read this and then go back to how you can work with the text the way it's written. But I want to show you two other ways first. Ralbag's approach, and I'm not going to go through it word for word just because of time, but Ralbag's approach, which I gave you here as number one, it's approach one, it's source number three on your sheet, you can see it there. And I took a quick look in the beginning of the class and saw this is the Art Scrolls read as well, they take Ralbag's approach, is to say that the wicked don't suffer. They disappear like the melting snow, but it's a quick demise. Because Job has said before that a quick demise isn't punishment. As far as he's concerned, they got away with something if they die quickly and painlessly. So what he's saying here is, in sentence 18, Kalhu apne mayim, he flees, captures swiftly across the water. And in sentences 19 and 20, just like the snow melts in the desert, that's the way that he suddenly descends into the grave and he's simply forgotten. That's it. The womb forgets him. Misako rima, or yishkacheyu rechem misako is another way. But the death is sweet for him. Olo yizacher, he's not forgotten anymore. And he is simply broken. And then you get in 21 to 24, you get this list of bad things that he does. He harms the childless. He will not help the widow. He drags along the mighty by his strength. And then in sentence 23, that's still part of his wrongdoing. The yiten lo levetach is the powerful people give him gifts, and the wicked person keeps an eye on them to keep them in line. And in sentence 24, if the powerful rise up a little bit when Einenu, when he's not around, they are brought low and they are crushed. So the way that Ralbag reads it is that they don't suffer, they do terrible things to people, and when it comes time, they simply die. And that's not appropriate because more should be happening to them. That's Ralbag's read. There are a couple of sentences where it's hard to fit that into the words, but that's Ralbag's take. And then the other take I brought on here, source number 4, is the Dat Mikra's approach. And he says, actually, that there is something new going on here. Remember I said to you when we started this speech that it wasn't clear what Job was saying that was new. So the way Dat Mikra reads this, it's an extension of what we said before from Mitzvot David, that God actually helps them. God is helping them in their wickedness. Go back to sentence 18. He says, you notice the different environments that are mentioned in sentence 18? You have the water, you have the land, you have the vineyards, and then in 19 you have the desert as well. He says, there are wicked people everywhere. There are wicked people who speed over the water. There are wicked people who live in terrible, cursed areas of land. There are wicked people who will never get to the settled vineyards. They live and they steal in the desert, and they sin among the snows, and they do terrible things to the vulnerable, and so on within the Dat Mikra's read. And then sentences 22 to 24 he reads as God supports this wicked person. In sentence 22, he says, this wicked person remains strong enough to overpower the mighty, and he rises even when he had expected to die. He's in danger, he's ill, whatever it is. Nonetheless, he comes back, and God gives him support. Sentence 23, Yiten lo levetach, God is helping him. The Yishain, God is guarding their ways. If God would look away from them for a bit, they would cease to exist. So, and I realize I'm speeding through it. I'm speeding through it intentionally because I don't want to spend everybody's focus on these other reads. I want to spend more of our focus on the literal read. But the three approaches that I've seen brought that try to wrestle with this, one approach is to say that the wicked don't suffer. That's Ralbag's approach. He's saying the wicked don't suffer, in which case this is consistent with what he has said before. Second approach, Dat Mikra's approach, God assists the wicked, and this is a new point that Job is saying, that God actually helps them. And then the third approach is the most difficult one, but the one that fits the text best. And that is that Job is saying the wicked are going to suffer, they're going to melt away like the snow in the desert. And so the question is, how do we read that? If that's really what it's saying, and that is the one that fits the words best, how do we work with that? Yes, Carla.
Is it not possible to interpret it as not the wicked will suffer, but the wicked should suffer? If you have a structured universe, that's what happens in a structured universe. They should suffer.
Right. So hold the thought. We're going to come back to that suggestion. Yeah.
Maybe what he's saying is that you'll see the truly wicked will suffer, and I will be vindicated.
But he doesn't believe the truly wicked are going to suffer. But he doesn't believe the truly wicked suffer. But he spent the last 24 chapters telling me it's not so. Where is his reversal? Why does it happen? And what's triggering it? That's the challenge here.
I think what we're coming to is the most literal one because most people vote
on
that.
No, actually most of them don't. Well, everyone else, when they're trying to read it literally, yes. No, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say it that way. Ibn Ezra, Mitzudat David, when they're trying to give a literal read of it, give you approach number three. I mean, I have in my notes where I think the other reads are difficult. I just felt like it would be a lot to start throwing that on people. But if you read it through it, you'll see the other reads have assume a lot that really is hard to find in here. The particularly difficult ones are sentence 18, sentence 19, sentence 20. Those are very hard to read with the others. But 24 also. So if what's going on here is that Job is suddenly spending the last part of his speech saying the wicked will be crushed, how do we deal with this? So I gave you a table of six approaches in source number six. The first approach is to say, drop it, go with what we gave above in sources 3 and 4. In other words, yes, that's a literal read, but it doesn't make any sense. So, you know, find some other way to read the verses. That's what Da'at Mikra does. Da'at Mikra says, you know, he says, here I'm going to give you a different approach. In the footnotes, I'll give you another approach. But that's one approach. The second approach is the approach that is popular among the older critics, and that's to say, as I wrote there, the text is corrupted. This belongs either with Bildad, it's an introduction to Bildad's speech coming in the next chapter, or remember that there are three visitors, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sophar. In the third round, only Eliphaz and Bildad are going to speak. Sophar is not going to speak. So what we're actually going to see is you have this section here that's problematic, and then you have a section in chapter 27 that is similar to this one, saying that the wicked suffer. And they suggest that maybe this one was from Bildad, and the 27 one is actually Sophar's missing speech. And it just got moved. So take a look at Carol Newsom's response, because she answers that more effectively than I could. Source number 7. She says, the presence of these words in Job's mouth seems to many commentators so out of place that they propose that the third cycle of speeches has been disturbed, either through accident or by a pious scribe who wished to mute Job's heterodoxy by giving him some proper sentiments. According to many versions of this theory, the material in 24:18 to 25 and 27 and 21 to 23 originally formed part of the speeches of Bildad and Sophar. The difficulty, however, is that no textual evidence exists to support such a theory. It is simply a desperate gesture in response to an interpretive embarrassment. I like that turn of phrase. As scholars have become more reticent about rewriting the text before interpreting it, there has been an increased tendency to interpret these portions of the text as Job's own words. Those critics who appeal to a theory of textual tampering abandon the interpretive task too quickly. Moreover, and this was a key point I thought, they construct an insufficiently complex character for Job. It's appealing to make him one-dimensional, but that doesn't mean you're right. And that's a point that's very big for her, not only in terms of Job, but in terms of his visitors, not reading them as sort of one-note caricatures, but recognizing that they're supposed to be deaf to the person that the person about whom we're reading. So so that's her response. That's the second approach. But the second approach is the critic's approach. The third approach that's brought is to say, and this goes back to something that Carla suggested also, that you could read it as a curse. What he's saying is, may this happen to the wicked. May they melt away like the snow. May they be forgotten. And in fact, that's what Da'at Mikra wants to say. If you take a look at source number 8 on the flip side of the sheet, he says, Mikan ve'atzof ha'mana ha'lashon kasha me'od. From here to the end of the speech, the language is very difficult. V'ne'emru perushim rabim v'shonim alaf sukim ho'eleh. Many and varied explanations have been given for these verses. Kan nefaresh she'inyan medaber b'ma'aseh harishayim. So we're going to explain that it speaks of the deeds of the wicked. And then he says, v'ha'aros, and in the footnotes, navi perushim she'inyan medaber b'klolos she'iyov mekaleles harishayim. He says, in the footnotes, I'll show you the other view, the view that it's a curse that Job is issuing for the wicked. They should suffer in this way, not that they actually do, but that he wishes it should come to pass. And so that's another way to make it work. Yes, Ralph.
Well, I get the impression that what Job is doing is trying to be counsel for the defense. he's trying to show that the other side, the wicked, are a benefit. Things work well for them.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, he has at everything. Everything has been destroyed
right.
in his life. So he can't be wicked.
But what's he saying in this section when he says the wicked are destroyed? That's what he has said here. Right? Reading the words straight, it sounds like he's saying the wicked flee and they're destroyed. That's the problem. He doesn't believe this. He hasn't believed this yet. Why? Where did this come from? So, yeah. So right. So the fourth approach is the sarcastic approach. The fourth approach is that he's saying, "Sure, you believe this." The main problem with giving that answer is sentence 25. He ends this section by saying, and Newsom points this out, he ends the section by saying, if I'm wrong, prove to me that I'm wrong. Prove that this is false. Show that what I'm saying is not true. If he really didn't believe it, why in the world would he end that way? Unless you're saying he's referring back to what he said before the speech with which he ended, but that's I find that a very hard thing to defend.
Well, he's saying that in your structured world and all the things that you can feel, this is what should happen to all the wicked people, and surely if you think I'm wicked, I'm surely not the only one who's wicked, but it doesn't happen to your wicked people. So, in an ideal world, in your structured world, this is what should happen to your wicked people, but I'm living sort of like in a reversed universe, it seems, because it's happening to me and to nobody else.
But he hasn't said that.
No, but isn't he implying that? I mean, wasn't his point all along, I'm not guilty, and I'm being punished in your world as if I were guilty.
Right. Except that, I feel like Iger Chasim and Asefer. Like, he's just simply making, it sounds to me, just like a straight set of verses. It doesn't, I don't really see it. I don't really see it there. It could be. But
we don't know.
Yeah.
We're healed.
Right. But that's the fourth approach to it. The fifth approach that I want to bring is Newsom's approach, in which he suggests something which on the one hand is fascinating, on the other hand I don't think it's right. It's fascinating. It's just too much I think to load into the text. But take a look at it, because it's very worth reading this. In source number 9, the italics are hers, the underlines are mine. One can imagine the friends whispering together in confusion. That's what we said. But he can't mean what it sounds like he's saying. He can't mean what we meant. What does he mean by saying that? What had been the conflict between two positions in a wisdom dialogue representing alternative constructions of the world has now become a conflict located within the speech of a single person. In other words, now he is, in fact, speaking both sides, though not, to borrow Bakhtin's terminology, within a single consciousness. Two different points of view, two different ideas. Job preserves the recognizably alien form, the words of another, to represent a measure of distance as well as a measure of appropriation. He is saying, that's not me, but he's saying the words anyway. He does not mean the same thing as the friends do, even if he speaks just like them. Job's exploration of the legal metaphor enabled him to envision as a real possibility both God's recognition of the claims of justice and God's violent repudiation of them. Right? Because that's what he did. In the court case, Job said, on the one hand, I am suing God for doing terrible things. On the other hand, I believe that God thinks I'm right. How can you on the one hand say God does terrible things and on the other hand say God agrees that they're terrible? It's not sustainable. He's made two opposing arguments. So analogously, where I underlined in the second paragraph, Job can imagine the working out of justice against evildoers even as he knows the realities of injustice. And then a good third paragraph here, just this sentence I think catches it well. Job does not simply wish to say that life is experienced as contradiction. He forces those who listen to him into a painful cognitive dissonance, a loss of mastery that is an echo, however faint, of what Job has experienced of the world. Job lives in a world in which he believes in God. He has promoted that belief in God all along. He believes that there's a creator and that you're supposed to do right. But it has brought about terrible injustice. His experience of the world is suffering for nothing. And so he says, you're going to hear in my speech both sides. You're going to experience the contradiction from me. Leah.
Could it be that the phrase in Pasuk Chav, the womb forgets him, he is sweet to the worms, he will no longer be remembered.
justice was broken like a tree. Maybe that is the ikar of the whole thing, that the wicked will not be remembered, but the good will be remembered. So all of the other things, bad things, do happen to good people, but at the end of the day, the wicked
being
will not be remembered.
So being remembered would then be the sort of the reward for the good. And not being remembered would be the punishment for the bad. Right. The only problem that I have with that is that earlier he said, who cares what happens after a person is gone? He was very explicit about that. So he sort of dismissed the idea that being remembered or having any kind of posterity is a positive. So unless he's changed
his mind.
Except, right, he's willing to change his mind about one thing. Maybe he's willing to change his mind about another. Rita.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. The Susan.
Remembered because we have children and they have children. Like, it's your family that goes to grave, not strangers. But since his whole family has been
wiped out,
thank you. His whole family's been wiped out, then there is nobody to remember, and that's what happens, so you're forgotten.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not just that he's saying the wicked are, like, people are forgotten, but if you don't have children, therefore you're forgotten, and he doesn't. Like, because people are remembered by their families.
Right, but I understand that Job will say the cutting off of the child is, in fact, and actually, I didn't go into it because I felt like it was loading too much, but the word avla in that sentence about being broken like a stick, avla being broken like a stick, we've seen the word avilim to refer to children twice so far. So the idea of, again, being broken like, it's the child being broken like a stick reflects his own experience.
I'm not sure. You usually remember it basically for your
family. I mean, a person can be remembered in a lot of different ways. I would not. I would be very careful about extrapolating from Job's view of the world to sort of sane people. I think that there's a lot about a person that could be remembered with children, without children. But it's true that Job will look at it and say, "I've been destroyed. The legacy I had built up is gone." I want to make sure to get to a last point in a summary, and I'm looking at the clock, so I'm just gonna hold off for a minute. I'll stick around after. I'm not gonna run out, but I want to make sure to at least say what I think needs to be said here. The fifth approach that she's bringing is an interesting one. I just think that it's overloading things to read that into what Job is doing and to say that he's now presenting them with a contradiction in his own words, like, see how you like it? It's fascinating. I just think it's too much. But I wonder about a sixth possibility. I'm not sure it's impossible to say that Job actually has changed a point. Meaning, in chapter 27, which is his next speech, he's also going to speak of the wicked, and also you're going to see him say that the wicked suffer. And maybe he is seeding that point. I still want to know, where does the turnaround come? Why don't I see what it is that triggered it? But maybe, in fact, he changes his mind. That doesn't end the book for him, because it wasn't his real problem.
Is he acknowledging that he might be wicked in saying that?
I don't think so. His main problem is his own experience, which is why the book has to go on. But he's saying, you know what? It could be true. Wicked people do suffer. But that doesn't address my problem. It doesn't speak to my situation. I wonder if that couldn't be, but I haven't yet taught chapters 25 through 42. So, you know, we'll have to see where that goes. But keep it in mind as a thought. So just to summarize quickly, source number 10 I just brought you, it's an interesting Talmudic passage. The sages are dealing with the same problem we are in approaching these verses. And they're also struggling with how to read them. And they come up with fascinating messages, and that's one of them that I brought you here in number 10. But don't read it right now. What we're seeing in this is Job's response to Eliphaz. Eliphaz, you haven't comforted me. I still want to put God on trial. God knows that I'm right, but there's no arguing with him, and that's why I fear what he does and what he's going to do to me. And then Job declares that the wicked are thriving before he gets to this final passage. This final section here may simply be a rehash of what he has said so far. A curse of the wicked, a sarcastic statement, it could just be that. Or it could be a new declaration that God helps those who are wicked. Or it could even be a cryptic co-opting of what the wicked said. There are a lot of different ways that you could really read this. I felt like I didn't want to just do this with one approach simply and keep on going, because really you're learning Job, and you can't just, like, if you ever meet somebody else who learned Job and they say, "Oh, what did you do with the end of chapter 24?" Like, now you can say, "Oh, we saw six different approaches to that. Yeah, that was difficult." As opposed to just not being aware. So I hope that it made some degree of sense. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What's the one?